Welcome to the final installment of podcast number 57, part 3, Bruce Regalia, winemaker for Cliff Family Winery.
One thing you did when you and I met, which was at a dinner during auction last year, which was in 2011, and you gave us a great opportunity, the guests that were there, to do our own blend.
Yeah, that's always fun.
Everybody had a lot of fun, and not only that, but it was smart just because it gave everybody a chance to meet other people, because many people paired up with people they didn't know. What a fascinating process, because when we sat down, all of a sudden, it was with a couple of women, and we felt kind of blind. Where is your palate at this point? I mean, you talked about these vineyards, these three separate vineyards that you had in front of you. Is it just strictly how your palate is hitting you? Is it there's some kind of special process you go through when you think of blending? Is it just simply how it comes together?
A little bit of both. I mean, you have some control over it. So the way I approach it is I keep all my lots separate. So like at Madrigal this year, I have 80 lots of wine. You know, so there might be 20 cab lots and 4 Zin lots, but I keep them separate and kind of evaluate them as individuals, especially working with a new vineyard. So for the vineyard on Hell Mountain, I'm trying to figure out what wood works, you know, some barrels. So I have a barrel trial going on within there. And so it takes me a while to figure that out. But when I'm tasting through the barrels every time, I get to a point where I go, this is the base wine. This is the skeleton I'm going to hang all the other pieces on. And so I kind of approach it that way. And then I make sure I'm not fooling myself, because some days you'll taste it, and you know, man, that's great. And the next time you taste it, it's not so good. And you know, I don't know if there's anything to this, but I have a friend that does everything biodynamically in Burgundy. And he says, never taste your wines one day either side of the new moon, because they don't show well. They don't show at their best. And I've checked it out. That is true. Uh-huh. That is true. That's not a good time to taste. So I make sure I taste them several times and I know, okay, yeah, this is it. And it's funny, when you barrel taste people through the cellar, people gravitate towards the same wine. In the back of my mind, I go, okay, this is the base, and now I need more fruit. This lot's fruity. I need more tannin. I need more structure. I need more acidity. And I put them together, and then I taste them with everybody that'll sit still long enough. And I put a glass on my desk the whole day long and see how it evolves over the day. I taste it the next day, you know, and just see where wines are going, because, you know, it's an educated guess to some extent, but you can kind of tell where wines want to go, and then there's where you want them to go. And so, you know, your job as a winemaker is more of a shepherd than a, you know, you're a counselor.
That's a really good way to put it.
You know, you're trying to point them in the right direction without forcing them into being something they don't want to be.
Are you making notes all day long, or is this just sort of, okay, kind of get it?
No, I have a note. You know, I have a paper memory that I write down my tasting notes in. But, you know, I do it over and over and over again. And once I put together, like, I'll put together 3 wines of, you know, say I'm making a Merlot blend for someone. I'll put together 3 wines that I like. I'll show them to people and I'll see what people gravitate towards. When I'm doing that, I'm tasting them myself and I'll go, you know what? All of a sudden, I wonder what happens if I put 2% Cab Franc in this blend or something. And so it's an ongoing process. I never do it like sitting down at one time. I can't. My mind doesn't work like that, because it'll drive me crazy. So I want to make sure, like, when I'm getting to the end of the blending process, that I'm pretty sure I've covered all of the variables and, you know, all the different permutations that I can, so that I'm pretty confident that's the best that wine can be. And sometimes I'm wrong, you know? I mean,
it's fair to hear you say that. I don't know if a lot of people would admit to being wrong over something like that. But is it a matter of sometimes that you don't do the same thing twice? Or do you follow that methodology? I mean, or maybe you start going down that path and it changes.
Nah, it usually ends up in the same place,
okay.
I think. I mean, just the way that my mind works, you know. So I'm looking at it starting in the vineyard. I'm lucky enough to see the fruit and go, hey, this year this fruit's not as ripe, or the seeds aren't as ripe. And so from the beginning, I'll treat it different in the winery. You know, I'll make sure I don't want to extract seed tannin and green tannin, so I'll do the pump overs different or whatever it is. And I taste my tanks every day, and I'm pretty religious about tasting the pump overs, because that's the first place to mess up your wine. And especially with Bordeaux varieties, and you get some bitter extraction and things as you get more alcohol in the tank. And so I have this guy, Gerardo, that works in the cellar, and he has a great palate. And so I've taught him how to taste, you know, and he understands bitterness. And there's a seed tannic thing that when you pump over 1 minute too long, you start picking it up.
Really?
And so when I write pump over work orders for those guys, I'll say, I think you should pump it over for 15 minutes, but taste it every 5 minutes.
So you're empowering him a bit.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's the best thing you can do. Yeah. It's the best thing you can do is teach your cellar guys flaws, you know, so that when they're racking barrels, they just don't, yeah, let's rack them all together. You know, I want them to smell every barrel before they rack and make, if it has a VA problem or something, they just say, hey, come check this out and see what you think, instead of just doing it robotically.
That's awesome to hear you say that.
Well, it's, I mean, you know, it's because I'm lazy, you know. Well, you know, if I give those guys the tools to do all the things that they need to do, it's just better for me. I mean, it actually is less work for me, and I feel better because I know that those guys are actually paying attention.
But it's smart. The whole thing is, it's smart what you're doing, because other than the fact you're empowering them and you're giving them more pride in what they're doing, they're thinking. They're not just becoming robots.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like giving people shares in the company they work for. You know, I mean, if you let people know that you care what they think, it's always better than, and they have a vested interest, it's always better for any company than just, yeah, I'm going to work and you go home at 5 and forget about it, you know?
Bruce, where are you from originally? Are you native California?
Yeah, I grew up in the Bay Area. I'm one of the few natives left. I mean, when I grew up, everybody's from California. Then everybody moved here and all the Californians moved somewhere else.
Because all the Midwesterners are coming here.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, it's funny you should say that because I live in Milwaukee. 4 or 5 people from California moving to Milwaukee. And I'm looking at them like, really?
Well, really? You know what? They can pay cash for their house in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's a problem. It's gotten expensive to live on the West Coast because it is beautiful, you know? I mean, you look at where we live. We're 3 hours from Tahoe. So we can go to snow. We can go to the desert. We're 1.5 hours from the ocean. I mean, it's a perfect location. You're close to San Francisco. I mean, there's no place better in the world to live if you like to get outdoors and have some metropolitan life, but live in a country setting.
I don't want to, this may be a question you don't want to answer, just, is Sarah actually, you know, moving on, or is it just a matter of that she wants to literally just sort of be on the fringes of what's going on?
No, she wants to be on the fringes more. She's got 3 kids, and, you know, she has a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, she sounds like she's real busy.
Yeah, she has twins, and she's very busy with other projects she has going on and whatnot, and so she wants to remain on the fringes, for sure.
Good. Specifically, let's talk about the wines you're making here. Obviously, I'm well familiar with your cab, but tell me what other wines you're making.
I like to think of it as 3 lines of wine. So we're doing one package. It's an alternative package called the Pouch. It's an Astor Pouch, and it's been a lot of fun. It's kind of made for outdoors. It looks like a kid's juice bag, you know, like it looks like a, you know, whatever.
Without the straw.
Yeah, without the straw, but it's the same kind of material and holds 1.5 liters. And we're doing a Chardonnay and a Cabernet in that. And I mean, that thing's taken off. I mean, it's crazy how it's done. And it was launched well and sent to a few states to see how it was going to do. And it's done really well. And I think we produced twice as much last year as we had in the plan. So that shows you.
It doesn't surprise me one bit.
I mean, it's, you know, environmentally correct as far as you can hold 2 cases of it. So there's no weight to it. It's cheaper to ship. It's in a container that can be fully recycled. And so it's a cool package.
And it's robust. It's pretty strong.
Yeah.
You know? You don't expect that when you first look at it.
Yeah. So that's kind of one tier. And then we go into the Clymer bottled wines, which is Clymer Red and Clymer White. And Clymer White is Sauvignon Blanc. In past vintages, it's had a couple other varietals blend into it, but it's going to become 100% Sauvignon Blanc brand. And that fruit's sourced from Mendocino County in the Delta. And the growers we're dealing with there that we have contracts with, they're like all the Lodi guys are sustainably farming. And Mendocino, we're moving that way as well. And then Clymer Red is always a blend. It's Zinfandel based, but it has other red varietals. And so, you know, it has some Syrah in it typically and some Cab and Petite Syrah in some years. And so those are both table wines, you know, and they're priced at, I'd have to check, but they're about $15 a bottle.
Yeah, they're very reasonably priced.
Yeah, so they're, you know, so those are wines that are made. They're in a screw cap package made to drink that year, wine that you can afford to drink every day. And then, let's see, then we go into all the wines that are cork finished. There's Gary's Improv, which is always a Napa Valley Zin, and that's a fun wine to make. And people love Zinfandel. It's a fun varietal because there is a certain, like, Zin cult or whatever of people that follow Zinfandel. Oh, I forgot one other wine. We make Root Blanc, which is another Sauvignon Blanc. It's Sauvignon Blanc based. It actually has a picture of Gary on his bike going over Paso Gavia.
Oh, cool.
And on the white road.
Nice.
And so that's a higher priced Sauvignon Blanc, and that's a lot of fun to drink. And that's always Napa Valley Appellation, where the Clymer Sauvignon Blanc is California Appellation. And then let's see. Gary's Improv, the Cab, Kit's Killer Cab, you know, which is always Napa Valley Cab. And then last year we did some Napa Valley Petite Syrah, which it got sold a little bit, not distributed nationally too much. It was mostly through the retail room and for wine club members. Oh, I did forget one. So we do a Bordeaux blend every year called the Clymer Limited Release. And that's always a fun wine because it's non-varietal. It's always Bordeaux varieties, but it's whatever the vintage has to present. So we'll pick stuff out of the cellar and make a Cab, Merlot, Petit Verdot, Malbec blend. And it's different every year, but that's a real fun wine to drink too.
Yeah, that's got to be a blast making something like that.
Yeah, well, it's because there's no rules.
Right, exactly. You don't have the walls to deal with. do you think that you guys are on the road to being a state at all? Is that what you'd like to be?
Well, probably the Napa Valley wines will be able to go more that way, you know, with the Napa Valley tier. The Clymer and the White and the Clymer Red and the Pouch probably will never be a state because the volumes are so big that it'd be prohibitive to buy that much real estate. I mean, it just doesn't work for the business model. But I can see the other wines. I mean, the other wines are headed that way. With the purchase of Howe Mountain and grafting the Zin Vineyard up on Howe Mountain, it's, you know, those wines are going to work themselves that way. And, you know, I mean, it could be in the future that we pick up a Sauvignon Blanc vineyard, you know, and that goes that way as well. So the volumes of those wines now are at a point where they could head that way. But the lower tiered wines, I don't see it happening.
If our listeners would like to learn more about Cliff Family Wines, how would they go about that?
First of all, you should like Velovino on your Facebook page because Efren and the crew here are really good at the social media thing. You know, it's like they'll keep you updated. And Velovino is cool because there's a lot of events there. There's music during the summer on the back patio, and there's stuff going on all the time. And they do bike rides from here on Saturdays. And those guys are really good at letting people know. And we also have a great website. So there's a Cliff Family Winery website, which is easy to find. And
the website is
Cliff Family Winery. And I think if you go on that, it kind of links you to everything Cliff. So you can get to Cliff Bar page from there eventually and Velovino and kind of let you know what's going on. The other cool thing that we do at Velovino is up on Howe Mountain on Inkgrade at the farm, there's a big organic garden. And so we're part of the community supported agriculture program. And so every week people pick up boxes of produce. You know,
excellent.
I'm on the list. So every Tuesday, it's cool. Every Tuesday you get fresh veggies. You come by and get them, and then you have stuff for the week, and it kind of, you know, I have a vegetable garden too, so it kind of supplements that, but it forces you to cook things you would never cook before because you've never had a rutabaga or whatever.
Well, just to be able to have, you know, fresh Napa Valley, you know, vegetables. Yeah. I mean, that alone is kind of insane.
Yeah.
So I guess the commute would kill me. That's the only problem. Bruce, again, it's President's Day. Thanks very much for taking the time and getting down here early. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Find Cliff Family Wines on the web at clifffamilywinery.com or velovinonapavalley.com.
Watch for our 58th podcast, May 2012, featuring Buck, Sue, and Brett Bartolucci of Madonna Estate. And Podcast 59 with Watermark wine owner and winemaker, Phil Steinschreiber.
Life Between the Vines was produced by Ray Pfister. Post-production was completed at Fifth Floor Recording Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Edited by Ray Pfister and our intern, Bob Warner. Original music composed by Tim Turton. Narrated by Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photography by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2012.